Yeah, thank you for being here. Thank you for listening in. We are looking forward, I think, to an interesting discussion. And in order to tease out this discussion, I'd like to hand over to you, Thomas.
Yes, first let me introduce myself. My name is Thomas Seifert. I'm a journalist. I'm editor-in-chief of European Voices, a quarterly published in English here in Vienna. And before I worked for Wiener Zeitung, Die Presse, News, Format, Falter, so I have a long life so far in journalism. Yes, maybe we start this off and get the ball rolling, talk about alliances for peace. When I was in Schleining and had the opportunity to follow the proceedings of the forum, one thing, a few things stuck in my head, but let's start with the first thing, and that was the discussion of Ukraine. Because I just, beginning of the month, I came back from Ukraine. I was in Odessa for a few days, speaking with colleagues and friends, and also, of course, with interviewees. And it's very much, the war is very much still on. Even people, I think, here, we got tired of it, maybe, or it's other things are now more interesting. At the moment, the Olympics, and maybe a Trump assassination attempt, Kamala Harris being probably being nominated vice president, all this stuff, and still the war is on. And I was quite surprised also to hear kind of how the representatives of Turkey or India, how they view it. And I had the feeling that, also for them, it's not center stage. It's something that is happening. They see that the war is not beneficial for them, not at all. It's high prices went up. But also I had a little bit of slight feeling, and correct me if maybe it's just me, that it's like, okay, guys, it's a first world problem. All the time in Europe, Ukraine have these problems, and what we have to do with it? And my thought was, come on. There's a guy from India sitting there from a think tank. India wants to become a part of the permanent part of the Security Council member. And I think, yes, then it's going to be your problem, because you're going to be sitting on the Security Council and you better speak up there, because I'm missing that, because we have actually one warring party being in the Security Council, that is Russia, a flagrantly starting a war against Ukraine. Of course, this is against the UN Charter. This is against everything that the UN stands for. And there we are. And I'm asking myself, could it be, and I'm a little bit fearful of that, that once the Pax Americana is out, and maybe we are in this period where the Pax Americana is on its way out, maybe I don't like the Pax Sinica or the Pax Indica, whatever comes next either. So there we are. I mean, what to do? I mean, what kind of future are we looking into? Who are going to be the guarantors of stability? Who are going to be the guarantors of peace that we do not really have in our time?
Okay, so you start with the very big questions. Why not?
Yeah. Always.
I think the discussion takes us back a while. So it takes us back to how international law has been applied and practiced in the last decades, let's say. So in this whole period of what you called, what you referred to as Pax Americana, and now we are in a situation where all of us in Europe, in the United States, we feel attacked, not only physically, as in Austria, we do not feel attacked, we are not attacked physically, but we are attacked in our values, in the values that we think make up the core of international law, such as it is enshrined in various documents such as the UN Charter, the Geneva documents, the Geneva Conventions, and so on. And we say, okay, there's this flagrant violation by the Russian Federation in its war against Ukraine, a war of aggression that in itself is forbidden by the UN Charter. And we say all the world should be with us in condemnation of this violation, and in support against Russia and making pressure and putting pressure on Russia. Now, the rest of the world has had experiences of similar kinds elsewhere in the last decades, starting perhaps with the NATO intervention in Kosovo, continuing just a few years later, the US or the international alliance led by the United States invasion of Iraq, continuing 2011 intervention, international intervention in Libya, and so on. So what they refer to, a very clear application of double standards when it comes to international law. So that is the first point where now rising powers such as China, India, but also others like Saudi Arabia, African states, Nigeria, South Africa, or Brazil, other Argentina, many other countries, stand up and say, well, you did sort of, in we could look at the example in details, but Iraq can be viewed the exact same way as Russia's attack on Ukraine is being viewed, for example. So why was this possible for you guys under your international law? And what Russia is doing, okay, we might not like it ourselves, but why is that not possible? And why should we then support you in your efforts against Russia, which might be against our own interests?
Yes, you're absolutely right. I think it is important to point that out, that 2003 was also an illegal act of aggression on behalf of the United States and Britain and others. But as a European, I would say, well, I remember there were one permanent council member, France, adamantly against this war. And there was number two, and I remember that very clearly, a guy called Joschka Fischer, who was foreign minister, and he said, I'm not convinced. And I remember this, I'm not convinced. I was also not convinced. And I think many people were not convinced. So I think that as Europeans, we have a better, let's say, when it comes to the double standard question, at least in some of these areas, not in all, unfortunately, but in some of this, I think like this more cautious approach of some European powers has been consistent, I think, with the exception of Kosovo. We can, I think, talk about this more, and also the responsibility to protect and other questions where we can also discuss, well, how can we view certain interventions? And so Kosovo I would put aside, because then I want to talk about Sierra Leone, what the British did there, which I think saved a lot of lives, and other interventions and peacekeeping operations, let's say. But yes, point taken. I think you are absolutely right that this is a problem that haunts us. And also you're right that the Pax Americana was not a pax. There were many wars fought by the United States. And also that, I think, is not really helpful when we want to make an argument. But still, I think, and this, I think, is a very important question you brought up, how can we bring the world together to say, okay, we have our differences in how we view certain conflicts, but maybe we all want a rules-based order. And I think there you have a good chance that China is on board, because they are, at least for now, I think the rules-based order serves them pretty well. And we see some movement. I mean, we had just, I think, Kuleba, we didn't hear much what the outcome was, his interaction with the Chinese, his Chinese counterparts. But it's interesting, I think, that there is, the Chinese are invested in this rules-based order. And I think Russia is clearly not. Because if you look at the ally system that comes out with, you know, North Korea is also not exactly a country that is interested in a rules-based order. So there is this, I think, this problem. But I think I agree. That is, I think, a very good way to go forward to find, okay, where do we have, let's say, common ground? And certainly, I think, I hope that the majority of participants in the international order are still interested in some sort of framework. But also, and I think this will be interesting, they all see that they need to have a bigger say. There is, I mean, where is the voice of Africa in international security discussions and debates? Where are, you know, certain Asian countries with huge populations that are not represented? So definitely, I think there is a lot of work to be done. And I can see that also Europe, I mean, we could at least say, well, why don't we go for a UN seat for the European Union? That would mean that Britain and France would have to withdraw. Otherwise, I think it's not feasible. And that I can't, and even now, I can't imagine that anybody would be you know, willing and prepared to do that. I mean, do you have any idea how to modernize this, you know, international framework?
I think this is a very, very old debate of enlarging or modernizing the UN Security Council. And I think for the reasons you mentioned, it remains a very difficult task. So what the feeling I get is that so you're talking about that there's an interest in a rules-based order. This is quite certain for the big powers, I'm sure. They do profit from a rules-based order. Everyone does in the end. But what we see is a crystallization of different ideas of what this international order should look like. So talking about the BRICS framework, which is still a very loose framework, to be fair, but still it combines all these states that feel sort of left out of the system, even though China is part, Russia is part, and they are in the Security Council and so on. But nevertheless, they feel like an alternative voice to who? To the West. And this is something that does worry a bit, in a sense that this might lead to a further fragmentation of the international system. So that, for example, in the orbit of China, you have your own rules-based order, which is different from, for example, the one that is practiced in Western countries. Then perhaps in the orbit of India, you have yet another one. Perhaps in Africa, around South Africa, Nigeria, or there's another type of order, and so on and so forth. So a sort of multi-order system. And this is against the background that there's so many other tendencies that we haven't until now talked about. So the simple fact that there is a record high of armed conflict, so the highest intensity of armed conflict since the Second World War going on, against the background of the climate crisis, against the background of very intense, fast and largely uncontrolled technological change. So many ingredients, so where you see, okay, the international order is shaking, is breaking, and there's a lot of conflict going on. It's a situation that reminds dangerously of the situation before the First World War, sort of when the system of the Vienna Congress had broken down. There was a lot of middle powers that were seeking influence, and that's a situation that is similar to the one now. So that's, I think, a place where we have to be very careful.
Yes, and you just brought it up that, in fact, the fact that we're living in an age of revolution, you spoke about the technological revolution, then I think June 22nd was the hottest day on the planet since records started. Maybe even now it's the 29th, I could imagine.
Yeah,
who knows?
You
know, there's that, more yes. coming as mm-hmm. soon as the statistics mm-hmm. are you know, cleared out and we see the clear picture. But anyway, we just have to go outside our doors in Vienna to see that this is unprecedented. And I spoke with a colleague from India. She came from New Delhi and she said, 50 degrees, you cannot survive. It's impossible. So we have these problems that Johannes, you said. And then the thing is, and this is where I think it gets really difficult for us humans to understand that, it all shouts out and cries. It's like, I'm an atheist, but it is like God switching on and off the light and says, guys, you need to get your act together. That would mean we need to cooperate. In fact, what you see is exactly what you said. The more and more we have these poly crises kind of adding on each other, and it means that the planet gets even more dangerous. We have enough problems on our hand already. as you said, you know, with climate, with maybe a technological revolution that we haven't even understood yet. Are we really yet understood what the internet means for everybody on the planet? I don't think so. And who knows what's coming? And then it means, okay, we need, probably a lot of us would like to see, you spoke about the situation before World War I, maybe also the Vienna Congress comes to mind, where we would sit down and hash it all out. I mean, this time it was a reactionary process back in 1815, but what would be like a forward-looking process look like, where we gather around the table and say, listen, we have a problem here. And where's climate, there's all these issues, and they're intertwined, right? Because the conflicts that you're talking about, why is it that a lot of them happen in the Sahel, where you have droughts, where you have not enough rainfall, where you have a lot of crisis between herders and between farmers and all this, and all this stacks up. You have social unrest in Bangladesh, I mean, which is also a country, of course, which will be feel the major impact of climate change. So do you see any chance that people could come together at one point to say, listen, we need to really sit down and talk about our issues? It all calls for a big conference. And all we see is, as you said, fragmentation. We see war instead of talking to each other.
Yeah.
It's all quite depressing, no?
So I think with the climate crisis, the ingredients for what you're talking about would be there, despite of the many other conflicts that are around. The other conflicts that are around are, of course, a huge distraction from the thing we should really focus on, which is the climate crisis. And there's, of course, two stages or two elements of that. One is international cooperation between the big powers to really curb emissions. And that's a thing in its own. And then there's a process, a UN-led process, the so-called COPs. But then there's also the issue that you pointed out. So it's not a coincidence that from the 25 countries that are most hit by the climate crisis, most of them are also affected by armed conflict. And so there seems to be a clear link, which is not surprising in a sense, because it's a sort of vicious cycle. So armed conflict breaks resilience of a country. So they can't deal with the effects of the climate crisis efficiently. Climate crisis in itself also breaks resiliency or tests resilience, and therefore sometimes also in itself causes conflict. So a very dangerous situation. But then again, for both these levels, when I said the ingredients are there, is that it is a common challenge. And at least in conflict-affected countries, it is an opportunity that has to be taken, of course, but it is an opportunity for conflict parties to come together and agree on this one issue, to fight water scarcity, for example, to strengthen resilience and so on, to mitigate the effects of the climate crisis, despite the other problems that they might have.
And do you see also, because we spoke about already, let's say some sort of bad blood between the global south and the north, not to mention the east or west, but the industrialized countries, when it comes to basically that security, what is kind of, for instance, in Ukraine, that this is on their behalf, that we want sanctions, we want solidarity, but of course it will cost them. And then again, with the climate crisis, they see that they have not at all contributed to this catastrophe anywhere near what we did in Europe or North America or parts of Asia. So how can you also find the balance in terms of they get conflict, they get droughts, they get a lot of instability, and maybe even losing habitat, losing habitat for their cattle, losing agriculture, arable land. How can that be? I mean, it's a global injustice, right? So how can that be mitigated? How can we address this problem?
I mean, in a sense, like I said, to support countries that cannot deal with the effects of climate crisis, and especially those that are affected by conflict, which makes it barely possible at all to deal with that extra challenge. to assist them in all the ways we can, in of course resolving the conflict, so that in a sense they become capable again of also dealing with other challenges. But also, if we cannot do that, or if we cannot do that immediately, to nevertheless find ways to at least bring them around one table for this issue of strengthening resilience, mitigate the effects of the climate crisis, and so on.
And can you imagine this, the loss and damage mechanism that's built in COP, which has just started, that this is a way to go forward to
of with course, payouts? And that goes beyond the conflict-affected countries. Not every country that is affected by climate crisis is, of course, also suffering from an armed conflict. And that's, of course, a mechanism for all countries that have a difficulty dealing with the effects of climate crisis, number one, and number two, feel like this has been caused elsewhere, like you said, but it is having severe effects on them.
Maybe one from myself, like a closing question for this part of our conversation is, what would you say with people who lose faith, with people who lose hope? How can the peace agenda be driven forward? How would you say people who do not despair? There is a way for peace. We can find a more peaceful planet. Do you have like a hopeful message, or is it all doom and gloom?
No, if I was doom and gloom, then I could not be in this business. So there's always hope in every single situation. There's always hope that you can convince people of another way. You can convince people to get out of their comfort zone. That's what it often is, the security zone. Sometimes you have to give them incentives to do so. But there's always the hope for that. I mean, that's something that I know from my work, fortunately. I think we are at the end of our discussion. Lots of what we have talked about, but also many things that we didn't talk about, are in our new publication, Alliances for Peace, which can also be found on our website. So more to be read there. But thank you now for this very interesting conversation.
Thank you so much.